Some people had expressed an interest in knowing what was going to be discussed tonight, so I thought that the only way we could do that would be to stick it on a tape. Stick it in my mind. Well, I don't really want to spend all this evening talking myself. The idea basically was to give people an opportunity. I had the sense after the events of Tuesday, I had the sense that some people wanted an opportunity to talk about it, not so much in the normal way that we talk about it, but to talk about it a little bit in the context of Heilkunst in terms of the way that we look at the world, and wondering how can we apply that particular perspective to things like this. It's a real test because, of course, once you see the world in a new way, it's not just laid out for you. It's like the people the pioneers, I guess, who came to this new world, as it was called, and not everything was laid out. There was no 401 and Queensway and Parliament buildings and Capitol Hill and all of these things that landmarks that we take for granted. So if we live in a new world that is based on a new way of seeing, a new way of perceiving, then of course we have to start building that new world in a sense. And one of the ways that we're forced to do that to some extent is by taking into account challenges like what happened on Tuesday and trying to make sense of it. Not in the traditional way, as Dr. Hahnemann would say, not from the perspective of the old school. We'll hear a lot of that. You just have to turn on the radio and the TV and you hear the same thing over and over again. It's no different than after the First World War, or after the Second World War, or after the Korean War, or after the Vietnam War, or after this new war that we're supposedly engaged in. I think most people who are caught up in this, is they don't know any other way to talk about it except in terms of the old school. You hear the same thing. I think for me the easiest way to relate to it is not to talk about it in abstraction. It's very easy to talk about it in abstraction, and yet abstraction is one of the evils that, in a sense, we're fighting, because everything becomes an abstraction and nothing is real. But you have to ground it into something that you know. And for most of us, at least, either as practitioners, as students, as patients, or all three, we have a grounding that we can use in order to try to make sense of the world. This is similar to trying to talk to the... I have to do that 2 weeks, weekends from now. To try to talk to a new class and talk to them about a new world. It's very, very, very difficult. How do you speak of something people have not seen, although some may have or had glimpses of it, but it's very, very difficult. And if you talk just in abstraction, which is what most people do, unfortunately it doesn't penetrate, it doesn't become real. And it has to be grounded. And you can ground something like Heilkunst, for example, and the full implications of Heilkunst and what it means in terms of the world that it lives in, with, for example, just participating in a homeopathic proving or taking a homeopathic remedy. And you'll see that suddenly you have something real. This is what Hahnemann called true reason, a kind of true experience which is grounded in truth. It is not an abstraction, it's not a hypothesis, it's not a model, it's not an explanation, it's an experience, but it's an experience that comes from truth. And once you have that, then suddenly everything else that you talk about, you can relate to that. Because if you don't, it suddenly sounds very fantastic, and it sounds very abstract and intellectual. So for me, one of the ways of trying to make sense of what happened is to ground it in what we do know, at least in terms of the world, that immediate world that Dr. Hahnemann has given us as far as medicine is concerned. And I think if you look at the kind of searchings that people are doing in terms of how to respond, how to deal with what happened individually and collectively, that you see, unfortunately, much of the same language you see in the allopathic world as far as allopathic medicine is concerned. You know, if the antibiotics aren't strong enough, then you need stronger antibiotics. If the drug doesn't suppress the pain, then you need a stronger drug. And that's the kind of response you get. It's understandable, because that's the world that the people who say that live in. It makes sense. In their world, it makes sense. You can't condemn it from that perspective. But if you step outside of that world, it doesn't make sense. And we know, at least from the perspective of medicine, it doesn't make sense. The answer is not more powerful drugs. The answer actually is, as Hahnemann pointed out to us, a more powerful diagnosis. And how do you penetrate to the truth of something? Because if you don't have the truth of something, how can you respond to something? We know this is the fundamental flaw of allopathic medicine, is it doesn't have ability to diagnose. It's stolen this very powerful word from medicine, as it were, and uses it in a way which is false. So we get diagnoses which are simply explanations of what's going on. And they're not linked to the truth, therefore there's no medicine that they can give that is linked to the truth that can make it go away. It's understandable that people talk about increased security, tightening things up, more control. We have to respond, otherwise this will go on. All of this language makes sense to a certain degree, and you can hear it again if you look at the war against, you know, disease. It's the same kind of war. And the language that is used with vaccinations, or that is used with medicine, is very military-type language. But the answer that they use in terms of more money, more research, on the surface sounds fine, but deep down, if the ability to perceive, if the view of the world is false, no amount of money plowed into cancer research is going to provide a cure for cancer if you don't have a truthful conception of what cancer is. And no amount of money plowed into lupus research is going to produce a cure for lupus when lupus is an illusion. It's a condition, not a disease. And so I'm just giving you some examples, but I think when you're grappling with what all of this means, you can say whatever you want tonight, you don't have to follow my train of thought. But if you're grappling with what all of this means, I think you have to ground it into what you already know. You have to start with what you know, and you have to start trying to shine that light onto other areas, just as we've tried to do with education, and we've tried to do with some people here in the room, we've tried to do with law. You start to see that there's a very different way of looking at the world. And once you do, then the logic of the allopathic world or the old school world suddenly doesn't ring so true. And basically, the essence of anything, as all of the spiritual writings have shown us, is the fruits that that particular approach produces. I was doing some research, and it's just happened to be, I'm writing something on the meaning of the word in the Bible that says, where it says, in the beginning was the word, or in the beginning was the logos. And so I was just doing that work, but as I was thinking about these events the other day, I had to go up and get the Bible for something to look at a quote, but when I opened the page of the Bible, it was in Matthew somewhere. I can't quote all these verses, but it struck me what it said in there, because it basically said that, more or less, that by their fruit shall you know them. And, you know, a healthy tree always produces good fruit, and an unhealthy tree will produce bad fruit. So at the end of the day, you can test something by what it's producing. It doesn't matter what the rhetoric is, or what the emotions are, or the feelings that are there. If they're grounded in a false view of the world, if they're grounded in a false truth, then they're going to produce more evil, in a sense. And you're simply going to get more of the same. You may feel good for a while. You know, the painkillers may take your pain away, or the cortisone may suppress your skin rash for a while. the blood, any, you know, hypertensives may suppress your blood pressure for a while. But none of those are going to address the true cause of the problem. So I think that on the other side, there are many people who understand that. You know, some of the messages, I certainly, patients that I've talked to in the United States for this, through this past week, I think they all had a common fear that what would emerge out of this was just more violence and more repression. And but at the same time, a certain despair as to how do you get out of this. Well, we have to do something. We can't just stand here and not do something. So this is the conundrum that people face. And I think the difficulty is, and it was said on that same page in the Bible, it said that there are two routes, basically. And one is the narrow one, and one is the wide one. But the narrow one is very difficult to get through, but it's the one you have to get through. And the wide one is paved. It's, you know, 4-lane highway. It's very easy to travel, and most people do. So the route that you have to take to some degree in searching for an answer within yourself as to what is an appropriate response to those events. Because make no mistake, I think you've lived something which few people live in a lifetime, luckily, which is not so much the scale of the event. More people died in the First World War, and more people died in the Second World War, and more people have died of, you know, hunger and poverty and sickness and other things than is the case here. So it's not a question of numbers, although you often hear that.
In 1 hour?
Yes, in 1 hour. It's not a quantitative matter that we're dealing with. Some people say, well, we've had this kind of terrorism, but never on this scale. Well, what scale are you looking for? One death by terrorism is one death. Whether it's one or 10,000, it's the same degree of evil. But that's, again, the old school way of looking at it. It's quantitative. There's no understanding of the qualitative concept. But I think what we've lived here, and I think that's the reason most people are either here or we have 100,000 people showing up on Parliament Hill and we have this kind of collective response, is that you've lived an experience which you could say is a soul experience. I think one of the articles I read in the newspaper put it very well and said that this event had seared the American soul. And that's not the case with most events in your life. And when it sears your soul, it is literally a mind-altering event. That the world before 8:45 or whenever that thing occurred on Tuesday is not the same world you're living in right now. Something has shifted, and you can't go back to that world. There has been a change in your state of mind, for better or for worse. And you have to kind of struggle with the meaning of that. So we're living a collective experience here, which is not so much measured in the event in terms of its quantity, but is more measured, has to be measured in terms of its meaning. And that's what we have to try to come to grips with to some degree, is what is the meaning of this event? And there are the usual questions that we have, of course, which come down to, well, how could this happen? That's a kind of secular question, and answered by secular people in terms of a breach in security, or the United States did something bad on the world scene and other people got angry at it and therefore decided to retaliate. That's a kind of secular questioning. Some people ask the question more deeply, either as a matter of reflex or even seriously, how could God let something like this happen? What kind of a God is out there that allows, you know, this kind of suffering? That's a valid question, because that at least is attempting to get to the deeper meaning of things like this. So I don't want to launch right into that. I think I would prefer maybe for people to just ask some questions or say what they would like to say about this, and we can exchange some ideas. I have a lot to say on it, but I don't feel I want to spend the whole night lecturing on this. And one thing I would say at the beginning, and I can explain it later if people are interested, is that to a large degree, I think the impact of this event is because in those few hours, of that event, whether you just heard about it or you watched it. I think in some strange transformation, we all became Americans. And that has a very deep meaning, and I don't mean it in its superficial sense, but in its deeper sense of what it means to be an American. But I think that's really what's behind the collective response. And so we have to get in behind, what does America stand for? Hi. What is this concept, this idea that we call America? Anyway, I think I'll stop there and maybe just leave it open to people to ask some questions. I just ask you to kind of grab the mic and speak into it for the benefit of those who might want to listen to this tape afterwards.
Should I welcome them?
Is it welcome? Who?
Being
yes? You can? Yes? Does anybody have any comments or questions or things they want to share on this? Can you just, sorry, just, I know it's a little awkward. I know it's a little awkward, but.
I personally feel that these kinds of things, they keep on happening in the world all the time. It's just we are affected so badly because it's happening in the neighborhood and it's happening in a society which is technologically advanced. And it's just a feeling people have that they are the guides to other countries and other worlds. How come it happened there? That's the question. It happens in Africa so often, we don't even know. Sometimes we know. And Eastern European war, it happened. Maybe, as Patty said, not so many people died in 1 hour, but maybe they did. We don't know. It happened when India got its independence. It happened in the Second World War, where I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of Jews were put in gas chambers. It's happening all the time. So that's what I felt, but maybe I'm wrong. The question is that, is it because it's in America it happened we felt that way?
Well, I think you're right. There's certainly one element that, one of the elements of the shock is that it happens, in a sense, in your backyard. But I think it goes a little deeper than that, because you have to then get into the meaning of what does America stand for. And by America, I mean a state of mind, which most people sort of live in, whether they're living it truly or not. America is in essence a state of mind. So this attack is really an attack on a state of mind, not so much that it happened at home. Yes, of course, it's very disturbing that it happens at home. But if it had been an explosion of an elevator, or let's say the power plant inside the World Trade Center had exploded and the same number of people had died and the towers had crashed, I don't think it would have had the same impact. So there's something more behind it. You know, of course, it's a terrorist act that's very terrifying and frightening. But it's not a question of the quantity. You're quite right. In Passchendaele in the First World War, for example, upwards of 100,000 people died in 1 hour. This is a massive scale that was a shock to people in those days. This created a change in the state of mind. The Jewish Holocaust and others, not just Jewish, but other people as well, who were decimated in the Second World War, that was the shock. The other thing, anything that is new in a sense for us is a shock, because it is it causes a shift in our consciousness. And so this was a shock at that level, certainly. But what we need to do to some degree, really answer that question, is to go back and ask, why is all this happening? You know, the First World War, Second World War, all the violence, the religious wars. We can go back to the Crusades and... Sorry? What's the etiology of the disease? Well, that's a bigger and deeper question, because it takes you into the whole essence of the evolution of mankind. And why is this happening? And that's a good question. And the broader question, of course, is why does God let it happen? Either God runs this world or he doesn't, or she doesn't. But we have to ask the broader question of what is the deeper meaning behind all of this? You know, in class we talk about disease, and people's initial response to disease is it's terrible. Of course, your job is to treat disease and to destroy disease. But in that process, you come to a very different understanding of disease. And you actually have a positive perspective on disease, not necessarily just a negative perspective. So, in a sense, as you go through your own journey, you discover that the things that supposedly were negative and painful actually can be the source of quite tremendous spiritual growth and change. So the question of evil is an interesting question, but it goes to the fact of what is the role of evil in society? And how do we put all this together? Because it is a very big question. In the allopathic world, in a sense, the material world, there is no... there's an either-or. It's either good or it's bad. It can't be both. And yet we know that good intentions can lead to bad results, quote-unquote. You know, a drug to suppress the eczema on the skin, a lot of good intentions behind that, but it can lead to bad results. On the other hand, things which appear to be bad on the surface can actually lead to good results. So the world's a bit paradoxical that way. And we need to, again, take that into account and inquire into that. But somebody else have any other comments or questions? Johanna, you want to take up? Yeah. You have to push the... Yeah.
The why it happened was very human. The why it happened was based on policies, it was based on greed, it was based on hatred, and it was based on the result of all of that. And this just didn't happen overnight. The why it happened was because some people became fanatics and decided to go nuts. And the implications are horrendous. Because now we're not talking about just lives of people in buildings or lives in a city. We're talking about lives almost in the universe. But when it comes to asking, you know, the reasons why God allowed it, God didn't allow it. God never interferes because we have free will. God never interfered in protecting the Iraqi women and children. Never with the Bosnians, the Kosovo, the Jews in the Second World War, the Romanians, everyone. So he's not going to interfere here. But St. Paul also says, if you turn away from God, he will turn away from you. And so I'm thinking that God had nothing to do with any of this. Where I see God is in the stories that are coming out, the stories of love and courage and the human stories. That's where I see God. I don't question the big picture, because I would resent God for coming in and interfering. And so what I'm seeing is a lot of positiveness coming out of something negative. And I think when the shift went from the community, the broader community, to the rights of the individual, then that was pretty dangerous. And now what we're seeing is a shift from the individual to the broader community. And again, I see this as positive. So nothing can be all hate. There's love. And I just think that once you have light and you shine it in the darkness, it's really, really going to take over. And I think that people might see more clearly what they couldn't see before.
The darkness and the light is what I'm feeling really confused about, because with the idea of polarity, and you can't have good without evil, dark without light, how does that translate for the future? I agree with what Joanna said about good things coming out of the evil, but does that mean this kind of thing has to keep happening for there to be good?
Well, that's when I was a kid, they used to say that was a $64,000 question. That's not a lot of money today, but when I was a kid, that was a lot of money. Now it has to be $1 million question, isn't it? Well, in a sense, to me, what it all drives towards is the deeper question of what is the purpose of the earth? You know, it represents something. And what is the purpose of our being here? Why are we here? And most people just see it as a kind of, well, we're here, and we live, and then we die, and we may or may not go to an afterlife or whatever, but most people don't think about it, although, of course, in all the cultures and traditions, there are very deep searchings on that question. I can only answer it from my understanding, whether that's your understanding or whether you can accept that as a truth, I don't know. But the way I see it, at least in my searchings, is that the earth, you could say the earth evolution, is a very fundamentally important aspect of the evolution of the universe. And there's a very profound spiritual significance to the planet Earth. And the part of it is what Johanna referred to as free will. And we have free will, but as a result of having free will, we also have the capacity to make mistakes, or quote-unquote make mistakes, to choose to go in the direction of dark rather than the direction of light. It's always possible. But to create free will in man, the world also had to, in a sense, actualize itself as a polarity. To evolve, there has to be a polarity. So what you get, and this is reflected in a sense in all of the religious writings, is you get a tension between the Spirit of God and what we would recognize certainly as homeopaths and higher counselors as the dynamis of God. And the dynamis represents the earth and the Spirit, the cosmos. So you have this tension between those two. But because of that tension, there is a polarity. And the polarity has to be black and white, love and hate, and it's actually fear. And hate, fear and love, not hate and love. But there's all these polarities there. And this is represented in the religious writings as a fall from grace, you know, a fall from paradise. That's what that represents. We basically left and separated from this very maternal, in utero experience with God. So there was no separation. In a way, it's like the child in the womb. There's no separation. And then there's a kind of an expulsion into the world and out of paradise. So, of course, you have this longing, which psychologists call going back to the womb. You know, we kind of like to get out of this world because it's too painful. And in some religions, that's a valid kind of search as to how to get out of the pain of this world. And this is reflected in all of the mystical, esoteric writings, in all the traditions. But for most of us, it's not a question of being able to escape the world. We're kind of cast into this world. And it is a world of polarity. It is a world of joy and pain and light and dark and suffering and bountifulness, poverty and riches. All of these things are simply reflections of that original polarity. So it's true to some extent that you can't say in a personified way that God created these things or God let it happen. But in a deeper sense, the polarity is a function of God. That God, in a sense, is the universe, is the wisdom of the universe. And God, if we look at the term God in the Bible, I don't know about other religions so much because I haven't studied this, but the original word that's used in the Bible for God is the term Elohim, or El, or Elah. These terms in Hebrew basically have the meaning of strength and an oath. Elohim means a strong oath, or translated into faithfulness, or you could translate even further into trust. This I find interesting because what it means is that if you know as how counselors what you have to get your patients to do in order to find peace within themselves is to trust. So in this sense, they have to go back to God. This, the word God is rendered in English, but it's really this term in Hebrew is Elohim or El. The next word that you find for God in the Bible, and it comes right after significantly, because none of these things are by accident, because this is revelatory language. The next word for God comes right after the creation of man, or Adam, which just means earth or hard. And the word there becomes Jehovah Elohim, which is translated in English as Lord God. Well, then you have to study the meaning of the word Jehovah, or Yahweh. And the deeper meaning of that is essentially a self-actualizing being. So this is the origin later in the Bible when God reveals his, I use this term because that's the way the Bible says it, reveals his true name. And what is the true name of God? The one that is the sacred name that cannot be spoken by normally except on the holiest of days in Jewish tradition. And that name is I am the I am, or I am that I am. What's so holy about that name? Because when we say I am, and we say that all the time when we give our name, isn't it? That's why names are so important. In our society, they're just an abstraction, but in traditional societies, names were very, very critical. They, in a sense, defined who you were. And this takes you into the whole meaning of why in John, in the beginning, it says, in the beginning was the Word. Why the Word? Because this gets you into two aspects. One is, it ties back into Genesis, which is the idea that what is God, what we call God, is not some personification. It's not a man with a long beard. But what is God is the unfolding, the self-actualizing of the universe. And that we are part of that unfolding and self-actualizing. And therefore, when we say, I am, and we give a name, we in a sense are connecting with that divinity and that process of self-actualization. The ground of which is trust. Because the first thing that is mentioned as being is trust. So that's the ground of everything that we have to, in a sense, get back to is trust. And that gets us into the whole world we live in, and there's not a heck of a lot of trust here. It's mostly mistrust. So we're not living in the unfolding of that deeper meaning, but part of the reason for that is, of course, is with the polarity and the self-actualization. The I am that I am allows for this tension. And allows, in a sense, for the possibility of what we in our human imagination would term evil or bad, you know, good and bad. We have this moralistic view. In the broader scheme of the universe, there is no morality. There is a trust. Trust replaces morality. Because with morality becomes fear. Fear that you don't do the right thing or fear that the wrong thing might happen to you. But if you have trust, there is no good or bad. There is simply life. And it's strange. Somebody had sent me a week or two ago, or not to me, but it was on the internet. Maybe Patty had passed it on. Some experiences that had been recorded by people who'd had near-death experiences. I always find those fascinating. And these were documented medically. You know, this is not coming from the supposedly unfounded statements of alternative medicine. But documented medically, allopathically. But some of these statements were rather remarkable because what came out of them all three or four that I read, was that these people had come back from this near-death experience, so they had lost life, or were in a sense of on the verge of losing life, which you know from some of your patients people want to do. Some people would like to leave this earth. And what did they say when they came back? They said some rather bizarre things like, I love AIDS, and I love cancer, and I love poverty. Now, at a superficial level, this is rather inane and doesn't make any sense. But if you read it in the broader context, what they were saying was that they had gained this understanding by having been given an opportunity to step over this threshold of the physical barrier that separates us, in a sense, from this life and the other side. They had been given an opportunity to see the whole, the ground, the trust, and had understood the beauty in everything that is on this earth, and had come back and seen the beauty, even though other people see only ugliness. How can that be again? Because there is this deeper understanding that even behind ugliness is God, is this self-actualization, this unfolding. It's not that God creates it. Increasingly, and this is the next most fantastic thing, I think, for people's minds to grasp, is the dawning realization that we are now in charge of this self-actualization. That we, in a sense, have the power to create the world that we live in. And we didn't have this before. And this power came to us divinely and functioned as a result of being kicked out of the Garden of Eden. It's in essence what we do to our children. If you look at the history of a child, from this very, very close, distinct yet not separate existence between mother and child in the gestational period, to being booted out brusquely, no matter how you might soften it by a Le Boyer method or other methods, it is a rather rude awakening. But you are very helpless. And in the first years of a child, there is really no sense of I. It's really only around the age of three the child first says, I, in the sense of a kind of dawning consciousness of an individual existence. And this grows and grows, of course, and the role of the parent, we call God the Father in our allegorical terms, the role of the parent is to increasingly allow that independence to occur, but also allow mistakes or bad things to happen. You cannot protect your child from everything. So when something happens to your child, it's not because you allowed it to happen. And Johanna's quite right in that sense. God did not allow it to happen. But it is still part of, in a sense, God's world. There was a conscious choice that you would allow something to happen. In the general sense. Increasingly, however, we arrive at the rather profound state of being for most people, which tends to produce mononucleosis in most people, which is separation. Suddenly this being has to separate and stand on his or her own. And as you grow past this stage of adulthood, of becoming an adult, you now take on a responsibility for your world, which you didn't have before. And in a sense, the parents are always there as some support, but increasingly they are not in charge of your world, and they don't influence how that world unfolds. They have kind of set it in motion. So the profound realization that we come to, and which quantum physics in the 20th century has, in a sense, driven home to us, except no one knows what to do with it unless you have a spiritual dimension, is that we are now the creators of our world. And this carries with it an incredibly powerful responsibility. Because what we think and what we do is what our world will become. So if you think about that, that really, really changes. Just like you can be in your carefree youth. You could do things and not worry too much about it because your parents would, in a sense, take care of the implications. But suddenly you're standing there on your own, and now you are responsible. It is your world, and the consequences of that world are what you have to live. And there's another passage in that same page, interestingly enough, in the Bible that I was reading, that said, and I think this is a fairly famous quote, but judge not lest you be judged yourself. And what this gets to, in a sense, is that if your thoughts and your feelings and your imagination run in a certain direction, it is you that will be judged because you will be living in that world that you, in a sense, have created. We unfortunately, the terrifying thing is, that we unfortunately live in a world where most people think that they are not responsible for that world. That somehow the atom bomb that was let loose on this world in a terrifying way was not a product of our unconscious fears. And it was. But that's only the beginning. It may not be on the scale of an atom bomb, but it can be just as terrifying. And what happened, those events that happened in New York and in Washington and Philadelphia, are simply an example of the new world that we live in. For me, that is the deeper shock. Collectively, but not consciously, I think that's what people are starting to realize. The United States represents an idea, a kind of... you know, the old Puritan idea was of a city on the hill, a kind of symbol for humanity, a candle in the window. This is something Americans do very much, I noticed. They put candles in windows. And that is a profound reflection of their state of mind, consciously or unconsciously. So in that sense, that's what I meant when I said that we all became Americans. Because the idea of America was this idea of being a beacon of hope, of being a kind of sanctuary in this world of evil, the old world. You know, people left the prejudices and the religious divisiveness and all of the negative aspects that they saw in the old world for this brave new world. And I think the shock of that event, that bombing, was that it seems to have failed. It hasn't, but the shock is that it has failed. But the challenge now is that it has only failed because it was attempted to build it in the external world. And what we had, unfortunately, was, in a sense, the building of that world in terms of materialism, which is what the World Trade Center towers represent. The kind of epitome of the material world. And there's nothing wrong with that. But increasingly, the answer, the meaning of America, lies not in its material wealth, but in its spiritual wealth. And I think if you have studied American history at all, you will know that that spiritual deposition took place in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence. And this was a bold experiment that had never, ever been tried on this scale before, with the kind of spiritual intent behind it. You could say it was a culmination of the fall from grace. It was the attempt to build paradise or heaven.